This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is March 4th, 2008. This interview is with Corinne Magnoni, the former assistant director of the Chazen Museum of Art, which at the time when she was working there was known as the Elvium Museum of Art. So, Corinne, to begin the interview, if you would state for the record when and where you were born, and tell us who your parents were and where you grew up.
I was born February 26, 1940, on a farm near Parkers Prairie, Minnesota, which is a small town, still has about the same population, about 900 people, in west central Minnesota, about 150 miles northwest of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And so I attended, I was one of the first classes to attend, not to attend the country school, but to attend a consolidated school in the town of Parkers Prairie. It had in my class there were approximately 50 students, and so they both the high school and the grade school were in the same building. I just had excellent teachers.
This was a public school.
A public school, yes. And it had it was consolidated, so a lot of the children from the country who formerly went to country schools in the rural areas, they came now to the town via buses. So I rode the buses 4 miles. I was 4 miles outside of the town.
Oh my gosh. So you rode 4 miles in and
four miles out, yes.
So are you a farm girl?
I'm a farm girl.
Did you have to work on the farm?
My father was very sensitive to, I have an older sister, one older sister. She is 13 years older than I was, and she was kind of had to help my father when she was born. And she really developed a distaste for farm life.
Oh.
And so he was bound and determined that I was not going to have the same dislike for farm life. And so he really was reluctant to let me help with anything. And I had this great desire to want to participate, to drive the tractors. And I, because I did, he did allow me to, you know, when I was even a small, probably 9 years old, I would, when they were making hay, I would drive the tractor and along the, I had to keep the wheel straight along the line of the hay, and my uncle would jump on the back of the tractor to make the corners. But I really, I love the country and I love the farm, and I love working with my mother in the gardens, and it was an ideal life. If you ever could ask for a more ideal childhood, I mean, I could not have improved it any. It was just delightful. And I had wonderful teachers. They were mostly graduates of the University of Minnesota. There were many who came from Concordia and Moorhead. But just excellent teachers, especially in the area of speech and English. I had a professor of civics who later became the principal of the school. Is still living in Parkers Prairie when I go back home.
Really?
Yes.
Corinne, was it clear early on that you were a smart girl?
I got good grades. I always got good grades. And my mother was kind of my inspiration. My mother was, her name was Frances. My father was Walter. And their last name was Brockop, B-R-O-C-K-O-P-P.
Oh, just what like, kind of name is that?
It's German. Ah. Just like, I think there is a head of one of the, I don't know, remember which department it is now. It's a Charles Brockup, who is now on campus. Only time I've ever heard that name outside of our family. But my mother didn't have any education beyond eighth grade. And she, I mean, she loved learning. And so she would say, when I went to school, she was anxious to hear what I had learned for the day. So I couldn't wait to get home to be able to tell her what I learned that day, because she wanted to know all those things that I had learned. And that was her way of expanding her knowledge. But she had instilled in me really a desire to excel, to continue with my education. She, my father was not that keen about educating girls because they only get married and don't use their education. But she was my arbitrator and really was responsible for me going on to school.
So the family expectation from your mother, anyway, would be that you would finish high school.
Finish high school and college.
Oh, that was clear too. Now, did your sister go to college too?
Mm-hmm. No, she didn't.
So you are the first in your family
to
go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Now, in view of your subsequent career in administration and management, did you have an early interest in math or logic, or what were your favorite topics?
My early interest was in theology. I
oh.
intended to, go into the work of the church.
Oh.
And in fact, I did teach in the parochial school for 3 years. I got sidetracked. And so when I returned to the workforce, I was working at a university, and one of the benefits was to take classes. And so I took the classes in business, and that's when I got my degree in business.
I see. But when you were in high school and college, interested in everything Korean or
Theology and music. I would say that would be my main interest.
Yeah. So it wasn't that far a stretch at the end when you end up at the LVM.
No, and I would say also I was very good. I was good in math. I had good grades in math, and of course because I was also musically inclined, I played the piano and a violin and flute in the high school band. They say that there is a relationship between music and math.
Uh-huh.
When I was taking some summer classes. I took some summer classes at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, and my curriculum there was economics, accounting, and business law. I was taking during the summer, and organ. So I would run across campus from the business school over to the music school in order to take my organ lessons. And my professor there was the first person to tell me that. Well, this isn't so unusual.
Oh, interesting. Now, Corinne, you graduate from high school then. It must be about 1958. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so do you go from there to Concordia College?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And how did you select Concordia?
It was close to home.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And I was very close to my parents, and so it was important to be close to my uh-huh. close to my home.
But did you live on campus?
Yes.
Or you,
mm-hmm.
'cause Concordia, St. Paul is still a bit of a trek, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Well, it was about 3 hours in those days, but there were a lot of students at Concordia who lived, in my area. It was common for because we lived in a predominantly Lutheran area,
uh-huh.
There were a lot of students who, if they were pursuing any kind of religious curriculum, they would go to Concordia, because it was the nearest to the Concordias, either there or to Moorhen.
I see. Okay. Now, your record says you have an AA in elementary education.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
is that exactly?
Associate Arts. And it was ours was the last class that they graduated in order to be able to, along with the summer class of methods courses, they allowed you to teach in the parochial schools with 2 years in the summer.
I see. Any parochial school or the Lutheran?
Just the Lutheran.
Parochial?
It was the Lutheran. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But it was the last year and that they graduated. They didn't require 4 years.
Oh, so that was a two-year program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I see. So what happens then when you graduate?
Oh, I taught in the grade school. I taught fourth grade in suburban Minneapolis parochial school.
Which suburb?
Richfield.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It was, school was Mount Calvary Lutheran.
You like that?
I did. I felt a little bit inadequate. I was 20 years old, and my first class of students thought it was really incredible that their teacher was not old enough to vote.
Yeah, it would be stunning.
Yeah, and then it was also, I just felt I wasn't quite. I just didn't have quite what it took, to inspire, to enrich.
Uh-huh.
But it's amazing when I think back to the things that I did, because I had the musical background. We had it was grades 1 through 6 at Mount Calvary, and they had a basketball team. But in the public schools, everybody has a band program. So why don't we have a band program? So I was, along with the parents and the PTA, we got together with, I think it was Schmidt Music Company, and we had a rental program set up for instruments, and I organized a band and taught all the instruments. And
You did. You are quite musical then.
And so we had trumpets, trombones, snare drums. We even had one violin that played in the band. And
so you are the band director?
I was the band director, yes, and taught all the and we wrote a school song, and it was amazing that later years my daughter back to visit one of the parents of one of the young band members, and she had a tape. I always regret that I didn't get a copy of that, because it really didn't sound too bad, what you think for fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. And in my class, I also had, I don't know if you're familiar at all with Paul Mons. He's a world famous organist in the Lutheran Church, but he wrote a lot of music. I mean, anybody who is in choral music knows his name. But I had his son in my class. In fact, he was on the board of Mount Calvary Lutheran School, and was really responsible for me being placed there. But his children didn't want to play in the band, but in order to participate, I charged $1 a lesson. And so he gave me a recorder to learn how to play the recorder, and then I taught his three boys recorder. And they so he had a recorder consort also.
Corinne, while you're teaching in the early 60s, is it gradually becoming clear to you that you don't want a career as a teacher?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Did you know what you did want to do?
Not really. I guess it wasn't. There weren't that many options for women in those days.
Uh-huh.
If I had known what a curator was, or if I had known what some of the various, or a conservationist, a person who would conserve artwork. I mean, think of those particular jobs. If I had known about them, but it was the options were teaching, nursing. And in my case, there was the deaconess program in the church.
Oh,
but
right.
That was, about all the things that I was exposed to or knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, that's why women these days, I mean, what an advantage they have, because all these different fields are open to them.
Yes, yeah. I guess I don't fully comprehend what that was like.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? You must go on to Lewis University in Lockport,
mm-hmm,
Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you end up down
there?
Well,
I had a first marriage.
Oh.
And so after the first marriage, I wanted a new start. And so I went to work at Lewis, and they had the...
As a teacher?
No, as a secretary.
Oh.
I had a cousin who lived in the area, and so that's what brought me to Illinois. And so I got a job there, and one of the benefits was to take classes. And so I started because I worked in the business with the vice president for finance, because I worked in that area, and really kind of thought, oh, this is interesting. I have an aptitude for it. Did a lot of special project work. So since you have the opportunity to take classes without any charge, so why not? I started out with one, and I added two. And before you knew it, I was going. I took three classes in addition to working, and I had my associate arts as the base, and then just took the business courses, and graduated as one of five of the first women to graduate from Lewis University, because it's a Christian Brothers school.
Oh.
And it was only
really?
Male, and so there were five women in my graduating class. I was one of them. And during the commencement...
Were you well-treated at Lewis, would you
Very
say?
Well-treated. They really... They bent over backwards to accommodate my schedule, to accommodate me.
Uh-huh.
Really did. They were very proud of the fact that, that I think that he was a member of the staff who was, taking advantage of the curriculum and what they had to offer. And they were very strong business-wise. They had a good faculty,
uh-huh,
in business.
And what was it about the business curriculum that satisfied you?
It's always having, knowing when you have completed the task, and that's correct. It's like accounting. When you balance, it's done right. and you have a satisfaction of knowing that there isn't a maybe this is right or maybe this is wrong. You know when you balance, you have a complete project.
Uh-huh.
And I like the order to that.
Uh-huh. I assume that has stood you in good stead,
mm-hmm.
that's probably a professional strength that you have brought, and I'm sure it was the case at the Elvium,
mm-hmm.
To everywhere where you have worked,
mm-hmm.
Putting a certain sense of order into things.
I think so. I think that, but it was kind of a revelation to all of a sudden. It was a big departure from what I had done before. But again, it was an entirely new, so it was exciting and new. I mean, I love taking classes. I mean, I take classes forever, and it was and of course, and being a Christian Brothers school there too, also you had courses in ethics and
uh-huh.
So I think the right brain, left brain, you know, both kinds of things being satisfied. You know.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are computers present at all at this point?
No.
So it's still all basically
mm-hmm.
manual.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I type doctoral theses with carbon paper. Talk about a challenge! People don't realize if you make one mistake, you know, you start over.
So it looks like. Now, let's see. So from there, do you go to St. Xavier?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was my first professional job.
Okay.
As controller. Mm-hmm.
And now, how did you get that job?
Just, of course, St. Xavier is very very close. It's a Sisters of Mercy school.
Is Lockport close to Chicago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It's suburban. Mm-hmm. Close. It's right outside of Joliet.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. And I don't know if the job was posted.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my first. I was visiting my parents, and I got the telephone call at my parents to come and interview.
Oh,
so it was very exciting.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I bet you were
mm-hmm.
pleased. And the position was comptroller.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go from there to Chicago State University.
Mm-hmm.
Did you leave just because it was a better job?
I left. Well, I met my husband at St. Xavier's.
Oh.
And he was the vice president of business affairs there. So
oh.
he was my boss. And,
oh.
And so he left to take the job at Chicago State and then recruited me to come along. And so I was there. That's the reason I was there such a short time, because we became engaged.
Uh-huh.
But the sisters at St. Xavier's were wonderful matchmakers. Your sister Gabriella, she was in the business office, and she would always have him pick me up. So, I owe all that. So Chicago is very dear to my heart.
Oh, good.
And St. Xavier's is I think Sheila Earle is a graduate of St. Xavier's.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Governor Earle's
mm-hmm.
former
yes.
wife.
Mm-hmm. And my husband was very active with the what they call it, they were the retarded citizens or the developmentally challenged people. The organization in Chicago was called CARCI there. And so we actually rented out some of the dormitories there to the organization, so they would be on campus. And it was amazing to see the young people begin to emulate the college students. You know, they all went to workshops during the day, but then they would come back and live in the residence halls at night. But it was a wonderful. And so when we came to Madison, we moved to Madison. We were married in 1973, we moved to Madison. He was also active with that when he first came here. It was on the Dane County Board, actually, when we lived in Dane County.
Oh, really?
For the developmentally disabled. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wonder if he knew, or if you all knew, George and Bernice Lightbourne.
I'm sure the name is familiar.
Because mm-hmm. he was very involved with the MARC board.
Mm-hmm. Jim McDonald was our good, I don't know if you know that name at all.
I do know the name.
Yeah, was our very good friend. And then we were also friends, who was the county, George Reinke was the county executive at that time also.
And, yes, yeah. And you must have worked with Curtis Whitworth.
Yes.
Of the
yes.
Developmental
My husband did.
Disabilities
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Board.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. So let's return now to you're at Chicago State University. That looks like a bigger job.
So it's a bigger institution. Uh-huh. So you have it was the former Chicago State College, I think it was. It was a minority school.
Oh.
It was a very challenging job. It was if 1968 to the 1970s was a very hot time in Chicago.
Yes, indeed, Black Panthers
mm-hmm,
and all.
Mm-hmm. And so this was, we were the last of the, white administrations. My husband was the last vice president of business affairs there that was not a minority.
Uh-huh. Was it difficult working there?
It was difficult getting to and from work.
Is it down on the south side?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And driving through the area. I always said if I could work there, I could work anywhere.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, when you stop at a stoplight, I mean, it was very, I wouldn't be able to do that now, I don't think. I would have more fear.
Were you frightened in those days?
No, not really. In
uh-huh.
fact, I sent these. You notice I was the accounting supervisor for payroll systems, and there were like three shifts, like of custodial staff, and they were all unionized, and so they would come in off the third shift, most of them intoxicated, complaining about their payroll, their
uh-huh.
payroll checks, and have to show them, you know, why they were paid, what they were paid, and you know, you were called. I mean, every possible name. I mean, I heard every possible name, but it was a very hard time.
There. A real culture clash for
it
you
was.
Personally,
yes.
I suspect.
And I took a political science class there on campus, and which was taught by a white professor, but excellent. She's an excellent professor, but he really opened my eyes as to why the political system didn't work for the minority people. In Chicago,
uh-huh.
why it wasn't working for them,
yeah,
and so it was, it was a real eye opener.
Yeah, and so from there you go to the Blue Island School
mm-hmm.
District,
and I had to leave because
74.
That was because of the nepotism rules in those days.
Oh, really? You
yes.
couldn't work because your husband was there?
Yes, and he was not my direct boss, but he was the boss. Of the person who I reported to.
I see. Boy, that's a real change now, isn't it?
Yes. Now they bend over backwards in order to be able to accommodate that sort of thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I can understand the sensitivity, you know, sensitivity of the people who met the man who I reported to. And I had a very, very nice, Blue Island was a wonderful transition. Again, I combined the knowledge that I had of elementary schools. It was one of the largest districts in Cook County. It was right on the way from where my husband and I then lived to where the school was located. So,
mm-hmm.
so it worked out well. And there's my first exposure to computers at Blue Island.
Okay, talk about that a little
mm-hmm.
bit. I think that's, what was your reaction? What was computerized? How difficult or not difficult was it?
Well, it was just just a giant database, really, is what it really was. And it was computerized. It was like this, was it the? I have to look and see what it was. Oh, it was the student data, which resulted in automated processing of fee billing. I don't even remember to tell you the truth, I think I worked with a data processing professional, really, just to explain how everything was done manually, and he really was responsible for then converting that into a computerized program. But it was a mammoth undertaking to get all of that data together, and then to be able to process that so easy without typing up all the individual bills. I mean, can you imagine? All of a sudden, it was a matter of an hour, you would probably be able to generate all of the bills off of a printer. And when otherwise it took days in order to type those up manually.
Was it clear to you as you looked at it objectively that computers then were the wave of the future?
Oh yes.
So you knew that more and more
Yes. Yes, it was incredible to see that, to be able to make the work less, to be able to do that.
I don't really recall generally from that time period, but was it the mid-70s when computers all of a sudden appear everywhere, or was Blue Island ahead of the curve?
I don't think they were ahead of the curve. I think it was a sort of thing that was happening in, at least in Chicago area.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Where were you all living at that time? In the suburbs or in the city?
But after we married, we lived in Crestwood, which was just beyond Oaklawn, Beverly area.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it would be like Oaklawn, Tinley Park. You've heard on the news recently, Tinley Park was still south of us.
Okay. All right.
But it was like 11. I think it was 11 miles commute, and it would take up to an hour and a half.
Oh my gosh!
For my husband to get to Chicago State, we had all the railroad tracks. Blue Island was the headquarters for the for one of the railroad lines.
Rock Island, probably.
Because we crossed railroad track after railroad track after railroad track. When we first moved to Madison, the first thing we said is, "There are no railroad tracks." There's only one. Couldn't believe it. Culture shock moving to Madison too.
Okay.
I mean, people would say, "Oh, we our first apartment was on Whitney Way, and the Bell Line." And people say, "Oh, you don't want to live next to the Bell Line. There's so much traffic." I mean, and of course we said, "Traffic. There's no traffic here."
What do you mean, traffic? So we now have you in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. in 74, and tell for the record why you're here.
So my husband's family was in Illinois, my family, Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And what happened to us, there was we were in an lived in an apartment in suburban Chicago, and our neighbor's car, he had saved all of his, he was an employee of Standard Oil, and he had saved all of his money when he retired to be able to buy a Lincoln Continental, and he had it a week. And it was stolen from underneath our bedroom window. Somebody stole it. And it was recovered like in Iowa full of bullet holes. And so we said, this is not a life for us. I mean, in Illinois was known for a good place for women to get jobs. I mean, they were very sensitive to employing women. It was a good place for women. It was a good place to make money. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a good place to be able to spend your money because it was... there was a lot of crime, and it was not a comfortable existence, mm-hmm. In that way. It was culturally rich, mm-hmm. but hard living.
Mm-hmm. A digression for a moment. In view of your interest in music and subsequent art, were you all partaking of the various music and artistic venues in Chicago?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's one of the things you really miss when you come to a smaller city. But, of course, Madison, I think, is very cosmopolitan because it has so many advantages and so much richness in this area for a city this size.
So how did you all settle in Madison?
So we interviewed we went to a university town. And my husband would have liked to have broken into university because he had worked for years in university administration. So we wanted a university town just for the environment. And we wanted to be between Illinois and Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And so we interviewed in Iowa State, Madison.
Uh-huh. And what was your husband looking for?
Administrative job.
Uh-huh.
And knowing that it was, you know, for both of us, it was not going to be necessarily, we didn't have any preconceived notions that we were going to be able to find a job that was equal to what we were doing in Chicago. But so we wanted a quality of life.
Okay, so you both started looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you each end up?
My husband started working at a company called Gorder & Miller, which was a consulting firm to dentists and physicians on the west side. And I worked for a year with Wisconsin Family Planning Coordinating Council. I don't think it's on my CV.
No, it wasn't listed.
And so I worked there for a year, and then it disbanded. And then I went to work for Wisconsin Education Association Insurance Trust initially, and then became the Insurance Corporation.
Okay, what is that?
Now, that's the insurance company for the teachers union.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So it's separate. It's a separate organization, you know, chartered separately.
So is that, the teachers union is, that's WEAC,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was out on the old Knob Hill?
It was, yes. It was actually, when I started, it was, WEAC was located beneath Knob Hill, was in one of those nondescript buildings.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And the insurance trust had, I think, 25 employees, probably even less than that when I started there, initially located in one of the apartment complexes off of Sheboygan Avenue.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's where we started. So we had a recreation area in for that complex, and then later moved as we grew very fast. We had also a building on University Avenue. In addition to that, the staff was divided, and then we built the building on Mineral Point Road, where Northwestern Mutual is now located. It's this gorgeous location on the top of the hill,
yes.
Overlooking Marbella, I think it is, and mm-hmm. just off of Yellowstone. And that's where I was housed, where I was officed.
And what were you doing primarily for them?
I started as the, I think it was the different names, but it was basically controller, but I also did personnel, was in charge of billing, almost everything administrative, personnel, billing, and accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And so then as it grew very fast. So it started out, I think there were like 25 employees, and I don't remember anymore how many schools we insured, but it was incredible growth. I think there was over 200 employees when I retired. No, we didn't retire, but left there.
Mm-hmm. And did you like working there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We had some in the early years. This is where I would be very cautious about how I word this, or careful how I word this. There were labor issues within the insurance trust itself.
Oh, I see.
And where our employees, the employees who were primarily women, went on strike. So you have a union within. You know, you have a union within the union.
Uh-huh.
And it was at that time, I don't remember if you recall, that Jane Fonda came and addressed the WEAC teachers, like the teachers conference that they have every October.
Oh, yes.
And said,
I don't remember.
Hey, come to grips. You know, you better shape up over there here, because you should know how to treat the women who are working for you.
Oh, interesting. Were you active in that, Corinne?
I was not. I was management. So it was a very hostile strike. It was one of the graduate students on campus actually wrote a dissertation on the strike.
Mm-hmm. Corinne, it's labor is always a challenging issue. I think it would be important to have a record of your perspective on that strike, what the issues were and how it was resolved, and where you thought the correct solution lay.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bargaining unit within the company, which was primarily clerical people, people who did billing, people who processed claims. I would say 100% female. And when we moved to the new building, this new building on Mineral Point Road, we had two executives, the executive director and the deputy director, who I would say it wasn't really the executive director as much as the deputy director, who had a very chauvinistic view of women. And the women were one of the things that really robbed everybody. There was a front door, and then there was a side door where they installed the clock for the time clock. Mm-hmm. So all women had to go in through the back door, mm-hmm. while the two male executives would always come in the front door, and the field reps would always come in the front door. This was one of the big rubs. And then in the claims area, which was on the initial floor, there was a very close supervision that was done. There was, on the different floors, there was different supervisory styles, but there it was very close, and when people would get up from the desk and go to the bathroom, they complained that they were being watched and timed. So it was kind of like a teacher-child relationship between the employees and their supervisors. And I guess the final comment that prior to the negotiations beginning that really fired up the women was that the men were meeting in one of the rooms, and the door opened, and the deputy director made the comment that no woman is worth that much, and which was heard. And I was my position at the time was controller, I reported to the executive director, not the deputy director. I was management. I would have been permitted to walk in the front door, mm-hmm. but I always felt like their token woman, you know. So they had their token woman on the executive staff. I mean, I was given that privilege, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't walk through the front door. I mean, I refused to walk through the front door, mm-hmm. but I know that may have been a wrong move. So that when the negotiations began, it was more a matter of respect. It was the respect that the women wanted. It wasn't so much, I mean, the salary and the benefits at the insurance trust are obscene. I mean, they're so rich. And and so it wasn't salary, it was respect. Uh-huh. And so they went out on strike, and I don't know how, it was over a month that we crossed picket lines. And, you know, they were, you know, dear, I mean, I felt very close to many of the women on the line, and
so this was quite painful.
It was very painful for me, but I had a good I had a continuing good relationship with all of them. But when the strike was finally settled, the personnel management, which had been under the deputy director, came to me, and as well as, I mean, I had to negotiate. Then I was responsible for the negotiation of all the contracts from there on, not only with the clerical union, but also with the field rep union. And I had no experience in a union environment doing negotiations. In fact, I really had a very bad, I had a poor opinion of the whole negotiation process. But I took some classes in negotiating tactics, uh-huh. and spent some time with, in that study of that area, but went to the table with virtually, I mean, no experience at all. But my how I got through the first contract was to say to the person who was standing in for WEAC, who was a WEAC personnel who was negotiating for the clerical people, was to say, if I take this back to my boss, they'll fire me. So I played on my femininity, I guess, in order to be able to, my weakness as a woman. But anyway, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I cannot say how, you know, it was another new experience. Really gave me new skills.
Yeah, you seem to be the kind of person who does not shrink from learning new things. You seem to be, is it fair to say, curious?
I'm curious, yes. And I like a challenge. I mean, even, I mean, I, even in my retirement years now that I'm doing retail, it's the challenge of the sale. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find that it's the challenge of the sell. And it was like when I came to the Chazen, it was all the dealings with physical plant. It was the challenge of sale, of getting them to do what I wanted them to do. And whatever it would take in order to be able to get them to shovel the walks.
Well, that reminds me not to come shopping at the Chazen gift shop then. You're going to make me buy more things than I want to buy. So I take it from WEAC, you must have made a decision maybe that you'd like to get out of that setting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And actually, there, what happened in 1985 is the two principals, the executive director and the deputy director, the executive director who I really liked a lot, the deputy director who I didn't like much, who I thought, you know, I thought that he was responsible for all the things that had happened, I really did. And he was responsible, I think, for leading the executive director down the trail. And they were fired overnight.
Oh.
In a coup by the board. And they brought in the former executive director of the National Education Association, Terry Herndon, to run the trust. And so that, but in the meantime, because he had no history and didn't have any history, then it was Al Jacobs who became the executive director after Terry left, and myself, who were responsible, really responsible for the transition. Mm-hmm. And again, that was a you know, it was Terry, Al Jacobs retired just last year. And I went to his retirement party at Fife's, and I was wondering, it's been 20 years, almost 20 years since I worked there, and I thought, why are they inviting me? I mean, I haven't had that much contact. I may have contact now and then with Al, but it was amazing all the people who came back, who were grateful for me staying at that time, and grateful to Al too, of course.
Yes.
That the two of us staying, as they said, because if it hadn't been for that continuity and transition, it would have been much more difficult to make the transition.
Yes, I can see that. So that must have been a pleasant evening for you.
Yes, it was. Yes, yeah. A lot of remembrances.
I hope somebody bought you a drink.
Had a lot of them. but it was a wonderful evening. But it was, Terry came in 1985, and I stayed until 1988. I developed in 1985 psoriatic arthritis.
Oh.
And so I had a lot of arthritic pain. And so I was going to find something different. And so my intention was just to, take some time. I had taken classes at Edgewood to bring my certification, teaching certification up, so I had, had all my classes for looking for a job to teach. I thought, I'll return to the classroom. I haven't done it in a number of years. I'm a little older, more mature. I really like children. Uh-huh. Maybe it'll be a different experience for me. So, the last class I took at Edgewood was in health, and all the discussion was on head lice. And aides wearing gloves for cleaning up things, student suicide. I mean, it was such a change, you know, a culture shock from what the parochial school that I had been a part of, and what's going on in the public schools today, all the things, all of the mandates, all of the, so I said, I have to look for something else. I'm not going to do this. And so.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's when I found there were two ads in the paper, one for the Chazen and one for the controller's job at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I interviewed them both at the same time.
Uh-huh. Were you particularly interested in the Chazen, or were you just sort of looking for a job?
I said, this looks like my dream job. That's what I said. I told Russell I'd pay him to work there. He said he'd keep it in mind. Yes. So it was, you know, the, you know, here again too, you have my university experience, a strong background in finance and keeping keeping track of money and financial reporting, as well as my interest in the arts. So.
Corinne, so you interview for the position at the then LVM, now Chazen, and you interview with the then director of the museum, who still is, Russell Panchenko. And you're offered the job in 1988. What did you find when you came on board? What were the issues that you had to deal with?
Well, I think the one thing I noticed early on was a kind of a fractured staff. It was you had Russell on one hand, and I really felt that he was besieged by other members of the staff who had been there probably prior to him being there, prior to him coming in, because he began, I think, in 1985. I came in 1988.
Oh, so he was new.
He was relatively new.
When he hired you, I see.
Well, you know, relatively.
Relatively.
If you think to his tenure now. But it was it was very subtle, the things that were done. I know when I started, there were two vacancies in the clerical area, and those two vacancies were filled a week before I began, and I didn't question it at that time, but they were filled with two people who were absolutely unfitted for the job, were nothing but troublemakers. It was the first 6 months of my employment I spent documenting their performance and the things that they were doing. I was threatened physically in order to be able to, to not have them pass probation. So there was it was initially the clerical staff that was my biggest challenge during that period of time, to get that turned around. And we had, when I started, there was a backlog. The position had been vacant since, I believe, February.
And you started?
I started on October 1st. And so there were piles of invoices in the that were paid, of course. Everything was paid, but nothing had been consolidated into any kind of financial report. So it was all the catch-up that we needed to do in financial reporting. And there was a conversion that had been begun developing a financial reporting system. And so I was working with an outside vendor accounting firm in order to be able to develop that. So we developed that, and we did all the catch-up. So that was that whole period, the first probably almost 10 months was spent catching up and dealing with the clerical issues. And then trying to get a handle on this undercurrent in the museum where the people seemed to all want to be their own bosses. It was very fractured. Like you'd have one area, the curatorial area, they wanted to be the boss. I mean, they didn't want any oversight. It appeared that way to me. And the subtleties of criticism against Russell, just to kind of draw you in so that you felt you had to be very guarded as to what you said. And but I felt Russell needed, he needed someone in his front step to be there to represent his interests, because I recognized early on his, you know, his talent and his extraordinary ability, both administratively as well as creatively. And you know, not often that you find somebody who is a curator who has also this natural administrative ability. I also had great respect for him there. And he respected what I did, what I knew.
Were you hired as assistant director?
Yes.
Okay, so that was, so it was more than controller.
It's assistant director for administration, so it's not assistant director of curatorial.
So my
area was administration purely. And that was one of the reasons he gave for hiring me, is that he said, you know, often if you find somebody who has had the arts administration background, their real interest is in the arts. And you always find them wanting to creep over. They want to push aside the administrative duties and get into doing an exhibition. I want to do an exhibition, or I'm interested in buying this piece of artwork. What do you think about it? Do you think this would be a good acquisition for the museum? But he wanted somebody who would pay attention to the administrative details so that he would be free now and again to be able to curate some exhibitions.
What was the financial challenge for the museum? Did you have enough money to operate with, or were you always scrambling? What was that like?
I never felt, I think we did good planning, and I think, and once we had the financial information, we had good people, especially when after Kathy Paul came, good people in the development area. She had good relationships with the community, did wonderful grants work. So we always, in terms of the planning for exhibitions that were coming up, did good exhibition planning. Mm-hmm. So that I never really felt the pressure of, oh my goodness, where are we going to find the money for this? Probably the exception was when we were faced with budget cutbacks. I think that was the challenge. But the deans in letters and science, the two deans that were there during my tenure, Phil Certain is the one that comes to mind, very supportive of the museum. You know, you could always count on the dean being able to support what we were doing. I really felt that. And also, and his staff, I mean, the LNS staff, I mean, they made my life easy. You know, the personnel people who were in personnel and human resources there, the accounting people, all first rate.
Uh-huh. Really?
I mean, that I cannot say enough about, is that how supportive, how the university is set up to support the departments. You know, if you let, I don't know how outside of letters and science what it's like, but I felt that it was just exceptional, the support that the departments received. In terms of, if you have any kind, and classes that you can attend, any kind of questions, if you have any kind of any kind of issue comes up with employees, that you have all that support to be able to go to.
Hmm. Now, you come in 1988, which is the same time Donna Shalala comes to the university.
Really?
Did she and the LVM have much of a relationship? Did you see much of her? Was the chancellor's office very interested in the museum? With Donna, you did not have much of a relationship?
No, not at all. She would come to, like major openings. I know that she was there for the opening of the Frank Lloyd Wright exhibition.
Uh-huh.
Very present
uh-huh.
at that particular event. Okay. But I think that when she was needed there to represent the university, she would always be there.
Now, in your early years, did you get to know Jim Watrous? Did you have much of a relationship with him? Because I know there are a variety of opinions about his degree mm-hmm. of involvement with the museum, particularly in the later years.
I only know him through when he worked with Drew Stevens on various exhibitions. And then I knew him also through Frank Horlbeck, who was the head of the he was the chair of the art history department when I started.
Oh.
And Frank Horlbeck has become a very dear friend of mine, and so I had opportunity to have dinner with Peg and Jim Watrous at Frank's house and get to know him better through that.
Uh-huh.
But I think he was an incredible man, very, very quiet, unassuming, but certainly left his imprint on the university
uh-huh.
And on the museum too. I think he's, what he did to get that all started, enormous.
Ask you about that. Corinne, let me ask you about the relations between the art history department and the museum. I know they're in the same building, but they have different missions.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work from your perspective?
I think in the early years there was more tension between the two departments. I think the museum people felt that the art history professors should be using the collection more. I think that was the perspective that we had, that here we have this wonderful collection, and yet you never saw many of the students from the art history classes up in the galleries.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there was, and So there was a tension that existed, hard to put my finger on what was at the basis of it, because you know, in the case of Frank Horlbeck, who in my early years when I first started there, he was the chair of the department. He certainly had a good relationship with Russell and with with the museum staff. But there was a tension that existed. I mean, I'm not privy to knowing exactly what it was, but that has, you know, in the later years now with new staff coming on board, that really has changed.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the art history professors, they use the collection. They also participate. They train the docents. I mean, they allow the docents to be, you know, really pass on a lot of their art historical knowledge to the docents. And I see that the whole atmosphere has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it was, the tension that existed, is no longer an issue.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that.
But that was very noticeable in the early years.
Now, you mentioned on your CV that the Chazen is the second largest museum in the state, and I didn't realize that. It's behind the Milwaukee
mm-hmm,
Museum?
Mm-hmm. That is what all our publicity says.
So it really was a larger, more complex organization than perhaps many people think.
Well, our collection, I think, now must be 17,000, 18,000 objects.
Wow.
And so it is. And the exhibitions that, I was looking back today, this morning, looking at the exhibitions that we've mounted, you know, some of the, you know, cutting-edge kind of exhibitions. You think of Judy Pfaff and the artists that Russell found to bring to the Midwest. I mean, the Judy Pfaff's installation of the Labyrinth. I mean, it was just incredible. And then you have Peter Griffin, another living artist, who has since then donated many of his pieces to the museum. You have the John Stuart Curry connection and that wonderful exhibition that
was a glorious show.
Oh,
I love
yes.
That.
And we were so fortunate because Patty Junker, who was the curator here and then left to go to San Francisco, to the De Young, you know, she continued to work on that exhibition so that it could come to fruition here in Madison.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember an artist who painted the top floor. Was that Gronk?
Gronk, yes.
That was interesting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there's exposure to all these different new artists who are doing new things, and yet there was always a quality in the work that they did. I mean, I really see them as being artists that will endure in history. And then you think also of Alvin Lane, how Russell, you know, cultivated Alvin Lane and his marvelous collection he brought lent it to us in 1995, and now will be coming to us.
Is that definite?
It is. Mm-hmm. Yes, he passed away, and part of it will be coming in. I think part of it probably is already here.
Really, mm-hmm. I do remember how hard Russell worked with Alvin, mm-hmm. who was a very difficult donor. I'm delighted to hear that the museum's getting that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did that require? Is it going to be permanently on display? Was that a condition?
I don't know for a fact. So that's what I had heard in the early negotiations.
Yeah.
And that was one of the rationales that we were using for the expansion of the museum. Also, that we had people who were willing to donate, but there was no place to install their work.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the Alvin Lane collection is going to be a wonderful teaching tool too, because it comes with all the drawings, the initial drawings of the sculptures that were done. I mean, he had a wonderful eye.
Yeah, I think
just
he did.
Just incredible.
Absolutely. Speaking of your 17,000 to 18,000 objects, were you under? I won't say pressure. Was Russell and the museum board always looking for more money to acquire more art? Was that something you had to deal with?
Never had to deal with it. I mean, we have a wonderful endowment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it was just a matter of managing and reporting, keeping Russell apprised of what there was available to be spent and what restrictions there were on certain monies.
Now, were you did you have good relations with the accounting folks at the UW Foundation?
Wonderful people, excellent. So Jennifer DeCray was great. I worked with her a lot.
Oh, you did. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there was never an issue involved with getting income from your various funds at the foundation.
No, not at all. Uh-huh. In fact, I think that also they bent over backwards for us. And I think too, I think that they were, you couldn't have asked for more cooperation.
Now, were you there when Russell received that $1 million gift?
I was.
Talk about exciting. That a little bit, what you heard and what you remember about that.
Well, what the story that Russell tells is that husband and wife came into his office, and he had been looking through auction catalogs on his desk, and they said, "We want to make a major gift to the museum. We would like to, but we would like it to be just one work of art, and we would like to make a major gift to purchase that one work of art." And so Russell opened up a page of the catalog, and he found one piece that was about $400,000. That was the auction estimated value, and he showed it to them, and they said, "Well, we were thinking of it just a little bit more." And so he paged through, and he found one about $800,000, and he showed that to them, and he said, "Well, we're still thinking about a little bit more." And so he found one about, I think it was $1,000,002, and they said, "Well, back a little bit." So then he had an idea as to what to look for, and so he then went on a certain search, keeping in mind, you know, the areas in our collection that were where there were possible holes in the collection where they could have been strengthened. And he brought, I think he brought back two pieces for them to look at. One was a Strozzi. And I don't remember what the other piece was, but this was the one that was chosen.
There was a sergeant, too, wasn't there?
I thought it was...
Or Childe Hossam?
Yes, Hossam. Hossam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And the donors, for the record, because it's no longer anonymous.
No, it's John and Carolyn Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yes, what a wonderful gift. I mean, it really is a centerpiece in Gallery 3.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing because... it's so characteristic of Strozzi. My husband and I were in London at the V&A in London, and in the galleries, and there was a painting. I mean, it was definitely a Strozzi because the Christ figure, identical. And so you identified it immediately as being a Strozzi also.
That purchase helped put the museum on the map, did it not, Corinne?
I think so. It was a major gift like that, and even though Bernardo Strozzi probably not a major artist of this period, this particular canvas, this particular artwork, was a major one of his pieces.
Now, when the Strozzi was purchased, was that... Did Russell have to submit that for approval to the dean of the college or to the LVM Council, or was it entirely his decision?
No, there exists in the museum the acquisitions committee, which consists, I don't recall any longer who all sits on the committee, but it's a committee of university personnel as well as the curator. And
members of art history?
There could be, I think there's one member of art history who sits on the acquisitions committee. And the curators work up the piece and why they recommend it be purchased. And then the acquisition committee recommends.
Mm-hmm. Corinne, let me turn your attention now to, you start in 1988 and you retire in 2002, I think. What are some of the issues that you're having to deal with in the mid-90s at the museum? Any outstanding opportunities or difficulties, personnel, financial, physical plant maintenance, not enough exhibition space?
I think that's the major is the shifting of things around the shifting things around the building, having to try and find space for our catalogs that we publish, for storage. You know, we had space for a couple of years over in the humanities building up on one of the top floors, one of the offices. And then, of course, they began to use that. So then I think now they have moved all the catalogs out of that space. It's down the street on University Avenue in, I think, probably the old space that was used by either internal audit or risk management.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a constant having to move things around, trying to find new corners or areas where to store things,
mm-hmm.
or where to, if you have people, you know, I mean, people are doubling up. Do people ever need to double up in offices?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have all the issues of privacy and you know, needing quiet time for work. And so I think that it's all those issues that come up. And mm-hmm. we have one. We still had the one issue that always seemed to be a problem was the issue of keys. We have one art history office that's on the museum side of the building.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, that still exists over there. And so I don't know how it's been handled in the more recent years, but it was always a matter of not wanting to, you know, like we could have used that particular office, but art history just would not give up the grasp on that. Because that was key to their expansion. I can understand that because they saw their faculty as expanding, and we had expanding staff also. So you're always looking for new spots. And so we actually had to move down, some of our staff moved downstairs into the lower level, I think one of the seminar rooms, and we have offices down there that we use also for photography, and also for one of the registrars has office space down there.
But now, did you have any oversight responsibility for the Kohler Museum?
No.
You didn't have anything to do with
mm-mm,
that?
Mm-mm.
And how big did the staff become during your tenure?
I think it was 15.
Uh-huh.
And, 15 bodies, not all full-time.
Now, you mentioned, we've mentioned in passing the Elvium Council, which is a group of collectors and supporters. It's not a governing board, per
no,
se.
No, it's not.
They're advisory. How much did you actually have to do with them, and how well did you get to know them?
I had very little contact with any of the, only contact was really during council meeting time.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would, when I would present the financial reports, that was really the only contact.
Mm-hmm.
And then you to see them when they would come in.
Uh-huh. Do you remember how soon there was starting to be talk of an expansion of the museum?
Mm.
You must have been involved in those discussions.
I think ever since I started in 1988, it was shortly afterwards, I think, that we continued, you know, to do assessments during, I think probably mostly during planning sessions, because we did operational planning. Whenever you get into operational planning, one of the big issues, space, and so we're always dealing with that. And I think probably it's in the mid 1990s that Russell began to do the actual quantification of putting together the graphs and making presentations to the dean, to chancellor. I don't know the exact time, he would know that, but it seemed like it. We were talking about expansion almost from the beginning.
And I don't know the current status. I know, of course, about the Chazen gift. Has enough money been raised? Are they going ahead with the groundbreaking?
I do not know that.
Uh-huh.
I know it's very close. I think it's very close to having having enough money to build, but I am not, you know, I really don't have any contact anymore.
Yeah. And what led you to retire in 2002?
It was really health issues.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You still liked what you were doing.
I love what I was doing. And that's the reason I'm still hanging around. I love the place. And I had a situation that happened December 2001,
uh-huh.
And so I was hospitalized overnight, and I had some heart issues, and blood pressure, and so I thought, I mean, this is it's time for me to bring down, although I really felt that my move from WEA to the museum really greatly reduced the stress.
I was going to say, the problems notwithstanding, the Elvium sounded like a piece of cake compared to WEA.
Yes, exactly, yes. And that's that's what I felt early on. It was that this is, and remember Judy Craig interviewed me also.
Oh.
She was talking about some of the frustrations and how you would deal with it, how you deal with the stress, and I remember that I didn't say, this doesn't sound like a stressful job at all. I just said I felt comfortable being able to handle it. I really did. I felt that this job, with all of the support that you have around you at the university, I mean, this was very little stress, and I never really felt stressed. One day of my tenure as assistant director. I mean, I really felt, the times that you had more work than what you could push off your desk.
Yes.
That was probably the issue that caused, some anxiety from time to time, is that you just didn't get to everything you needed to get to.
Now, from your perspective, has the museum become more visible? Are there more people coming to it?
I believe so. It really seems that way. Even from being in the museum shop, you have when you're in the offices, you don't have the opportunity to see all the people who are coming in and where they're coming from.
Right.
And I think that's the exciting part of being where I am in the shop, is because you see people from all over the world. You have people who come in and say, "This is just a gem." And they liken it onto one of the small museums in Washington, D.C. I can't remember offhand what it was, the Phillips collection. They said, "This is just like the Phillips collection. It is a jewel." Mm-hmm. Of all the artists that are represented, what a wonderful collection it is, and what an easy building it is to get around, and to have all these comments of people from all over the world, people who have traveled, people who know museums. I mean, it really is heartening.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I really feel poorly about, and I think I'll mention this while I'm thinking of it, is kind of the lack of physical care for the building. And it's not due to any of our, it's a university problem. It's now, if you drive up to the museum today and you drive past the museum, the front is not shoveled at all. The school kids that are coming in are trudging in, over the snowbanks. And there's a huge paper box that's laying in front of the museum. And the sidewalks around the museum are not shoveled. They're all ice covered. In fact, when I came into work, I think it was last week, you have to inch your way across all of the ice. It was a pleasure walking over here because the sidewalks are shoveled. But it is really a problem there. Here is a public building that is not given the attention, and not in terms of cleanliness either. It doesn't have the custodial. We don't have the custodial help to keep that building clean.
Really? Is that a problem? Is that a recent phenomenon or a long-standing?
It was always something that I would have to bargain for. But
really?
But they always were responsive. In the long run, it would come down to, if I would call enough times, I would get done what I needed to get done.
And when you called, whom did you call?
Well, a physical plant, I mean, all the way up to the person who's responsible for custodial, the assistant director, my counterpart, physical plant.
Mm-hmm.
I think this year especially, I think this is the first year where I really noticed it, that the floors are dirty. We also lost Mike Skinner, who was a custodial person for years, and who had been assigned to the museum for years, and who took a great deal of pride to keeping the museum spotless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think losing him, he retired.
Oh.
And there's been no one to take his place.
No one who loves it.
Yeah. Yes. And that is the key. And over the years, I think we've had people who have been in positions, support positions, who've had a very personal identity with the museum, and who took great personal pride in being associated with the museum. I mean, like our security guards, we have just had wonderful security officers there, And now we have one person who still remains there, who was there when I left, kids Ken Kraus. You know, just extraordinary person, extraordinary interested in the collection and in the people who visit and doing the right thing. I mean, great attention.
Corinne, speaking of security, did you ever have issues of vandalism or violation that were of any magnitude?
Mostly we had just accidents.
Ah, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. You know, people backing in to pieces of art.
I see, mm-hmm. Yeah. But you never had anybody attack a piece of art or anything?
No.
Thank God, huh?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the Sunday performance schedule, Afternoon Live.
Mm-hmm.
You were responsible for that,
mm-hmm.
weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a very successful program.
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
Did you start that or did inherit it?
No, I inherited it. And it had been, I think it's how many years? It started probably shortly after the museum opened.
Which would be in 1970.
Number of years. But really, and it had been... Different people had responsibility. When I first started, I think the person who was in membership was responsible for hiring the coordinator, and then you had the responsibility of working with people from Wisconsin Public Radio,
mm-hmm.
and that too again over the years with Bill Lutz, and then later Vicki Nunn,
mm-hmm.
Who were the producers
mm-hmm.
for the program, and. Bill Lewis has spent some time codifying our arrangement and getting it down in writing, which was, I think, a very good thing to do because up until that time it had been kind of loose.
Uh-huh.
And this way it indicated who was responsible for what. And I think that is when each department knows what their responsibilities are and what they need to do, things are going to go much smoother mm-hmm. from year to year, just a matter of just kind of keeping it going.
It's a wonderful venue to listen
yes.
to music.
Yeah.
I like to. I always listen to it on Sunday. And sometimes I go down.
Mm-hmm.
I just like to sit in the gallery and...
And just to hear the music. You don't have to even be in the concert. And Lori Skelton, she added a wonderful thing, those little intermission segments.
Uh-huh.
Initially, it was just Russell and a guest that were interviewed. But it was her idea... That she be involved also, and it made it more, gave more continuity to the radio broadcast because
uh-huh.
she was announcing, and she would go to the intermission segment, and it really appeared that it was being done during the intermission because of her involvement. I thought that was a really nice feature that she added.
Let me ask you your opinion of when the name changed from the Elvium to the Chazen. Did you have a reaction to that?
Well, I felt kind of orphaned. You know how you have all an understanding why it was done, and with great gratitude to the Chazen family, but you have all of this these years that have been tied up with the Elvium Museum of Art,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes your identity. You know your identity. I work for the Elvium Museum of Art,
mm-hmm.
But I guess it isn't that much difference saying I work for the Chazen. I work for the Elvium, now known as the Chazen Museum of Art. And
did you get a lot of criticism from friends?
We people, yes. I shouldn't say a lot. You know, from time to time.
Uh-huh.
And what seemed to satisfy, or at least put a smiling face on it, was if you pointed out to people in the museum shop. That's where you would hear, I think, security probably, as well as museum shop personnel hearing. When did the name change? Why is it changing? But if you would point out that this building will always be the Elvium building. See on the wall, this building is dedicated to the memory of Conrad Elvium. This will always be the Elvium building. If you look at the doors, it's the Elvium building. We're just the Chazen Museum within the Elvium building. And really it helps to clarify, you know, the relationship within the building because Art History Department is also in this building.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kohler Art Library is also in this building, and now the Chazen Museum is also in this building.
Mm-hmm.
So all three entities are now in the Elvium building, and I think that seems to satisfy people a bit.
Uh-huh. I suspect it does.
Mm-hmm.
I was ambivalent myself about it.
Yeah, I think everybody who has had a connection, you had the connection too, and you just the Elvium name was a unique name. It was a devil to spell, but but it was
that's an understatement.
Yeah, but it was a unique name.
It was.
And also just had a great identity with the city and all of the things in the city that are named after the Elvium family.
What do you see coming down the pike for the Chazen? If you had a crystal ball, Corinne, and you were thinking about the next half century, what do you think the Chazen is going to do? What are some of the issues facing it?
I think the big challenge is going to be planning for the expansion and planning for the operational needs. Wonderful thing that has happened is that we have hired a new assistant director for administration at the museum. Just on staff now for about a month. Name is Brian Thompson. And he comes from, he's had experience in Washington, D.C., as well as in New York State, working and very strong background in strategic planning and in operational planning. And I think I sat in on the interviews, and I think the one thing we were struck with is that he has going to be a wonderful hands-on help mate for the organization to be able to plan for the expansion and what our needs are going to be, what our needs are going to be in terms of staffing and what our needs are going to be in terms of equipment and how we are going to strategically work between these two buildings. And so I think that he is a wonderful addition to the staff. And I think he's going to help with all the challenges, the things that everybody's been thinking of, kind of taking the pressure off the individual staff members, because you have somebody now who we feel can really lead the planning for the new building.
Mm-hmm. When's the new building supposed to open?
Is it 2010, 2011? I think that.
Is it that soon?
Mm-hmm. They're going to have to dig pretty soon.
Not my problem.
Yes. I've been waiting for the Peterson Building to come down, but I'm not sure.
There's going to be a walkway between the two buildings,
yes,
is that right?
The design is just beautiful. It's just beautiful. And the integration of the bringing the two buildings together, the architect that that has been hired is really just done incredible things, I think, from the sketches that I've seen.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's going to be a beautiful building.
Time at the university.
Mm-hmm.
Corinne, as we move toward the end of the interview, I want to ask you, what are your sort of final observations about the museum as you think about, you spent 14 very productive years there and through a very vital transition time, I think coming when Russell was new to where it's now about to expand dramatically. What do you think about the museum?
Well, I agree with you. I think it's what you said earlier is that it is really the jewel of the university. I think that the collection is extraordinary. I think it's a wonderful teaching tool. I'm excited that now I work also as a docent, and I've been leading some tours to see the impact that you can have on these young children that are coming through, coming to the museum for the first time, giving them exposure to the art, and the impressions that and the appreciation that they can learn at a young age that will be with them all their lives. And so I'm incredibly honored to have been employed there in the position that I was employed, to have made any contribution that I may have made. And I just think that the university is very fortunate to be able to have such an extraordinary museum collection, and also to have such a great staff. I think we have people who have longevity there. You have Ann Lambert, who has been the curator of education almost since the museum opened. Much beloved by the teachers in the state, much beloved by her docents, still fresh I mean, I just marvel at the woman, because after all these years, she's still fresh and comes in with new ideas and new ideas for educational programming, and she has all these wonderful contacts. And, you know, Drew Stevens, you know, he came as a young curator, and he has expanded and has had the collection, the print collection has grown under his watchful eye. Making it accessible to the state of Wisconsin, the people of the state of Wisconsin, any of our visitors. Just a great teacher. He's just a wonderful teacher as well as a wonderful curator. How could you be so lucky to have these people? Mm-hmm. And then to have a director who's a visionary and just an incredible talent, such a good eye for art. I mean, how fortunate to have these people. Mm-hmm. And all the new people who have been coming, who are now part also since, you know, since I've retired, it's been great. I think it's a wonderful. I think only the future can only be better with the new building and Alvin Lane's collection and all the collections that will now come because of expanded space too.
Speaking of Alvin Lane, you must remember that glorious dinner that Russell threw. Was that in Gallery 3?
Yes, it was. Yes.
For Alvin Lane.
Yes.
Boy, Russell really worked on that.
It was a wonder. That's one of my, you know, memories too. To see him and his family and how proud they were to have the collection here.
Now, when you give a tour of the Chazen, mm-hmm. do you have a favorite section, Corinne? Is there some gallery where you linger a little longer that you particularly enjoy?
Well, it depends on the age group. I never really had an appreciation for the top floor, which is the contemporary works, but I found that is fertile ground for young minds. They can see things, the young first, second, third, fourth graders, they can see things in those paintings that I've never seen. And find little games to play for them to look at the labels. I mean, that has become the spot where I like to take the children. But as far as my favorite gallery, then I like Gallery 3. Gallery 3 is my favorite gallery. Uh-huh. And then I would say 3, 4, and 5. Mm-hmm. 3, 4, and 5. Mm-hmm. And then there are docents who love the Greek and enrollment. I have trouble getting into that.
It's okay. There isn't a right or wrong answer here.
That's what I keep on telling the children. There's no right or wrong answer.
At this point, this concludes the interview with the very gracious and accomplished Corinne Magnoni. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Corinne.
Thank you so much for considering me. For this.
No, you bet. You now belong to the ages.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bob.